Well, you're listening to Stages, and this evening I am talking with playwright Lachlan Philpott. He's a playwright, director, teacher. His plays have been performed across Australia and internationally. He's won scholarships, he's an award winner, and he's here to talk with us about his life and what he's doing now. Welcome to Stages, Lachlan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into you as a playwright, let's get an idea of where you are from. Where are you from?
I lived the first 5 or 6 years of my life out in Western New South Wales. So I was born in Sydney and then we went straight out there. I think probably they decided not to trust the hospital out there. I don't know. But anyway, so I lived in Narromine. I've got a lot of memories from Narromine, some very odd memories of rats and locusts and things like that coming through. And then after those years, I moved into Sydney. But I've kind of lived in a lot of places. I've been very lucky. I've lived in Canada when I was a kid. My dad was a teacher and we went on a teacher's exchange. And so I lived in Toronto for a year, and I've lived in the UK as well as the US and in France as well. So kind of been lucky to move around a lot and
Wow.
as well, yeah. And mum was a journalist, among other things, but they ran a youth theatre company area that I grew up in Sydney, which went for 25 years. So they were very committed to running a youth theatre company. And it's amazing all the people who were a part of that was called Forest Youth Theatre, which ran out of Glen Street. And I think they began it because the council was building a theatre and they didn't just want it to be, the shows that probably still are going on there now. And so they began this youth theatre company, and I think the philosophy behind it was not so much about kind of innovation or the quality of work was strong, but they did musicals. But I think what was important to my dad in particular was that anyone who wanted to be a part of it could be a part of it, which meant in some ways that it was kind of ridiculous numbers of people, kids on stage, like, you know, they did a whole range of different musicals, but there was always over 100 kids in the cast, which is pretty mean feat to costume and so forth. So they had an army of volunteers who all put in a huge amount of time to do it. But the philosophy behind it was, you know, that for kids who didn't maybe want to play sport, it was a place where they could belong and go and do something very different. So it's kind of, I guess, that inspired my interest in theatre and my passion for youth theatre.
Did you perform, or did you start out playwriting for them, or how did you become a playwright?
So I acted in a lot of them. Yeah, and I was terrible in a lot of them. I was Seymour in the Little Shop of Horrors when they did Little Shop of Horrors, and I think sometimes people thought that I got the role because, you know,
nepotism.
I don't think it was nepotism, but, you know, I mean, it's easy to say that when you get the role. I played Seymour a few other times. I played it in Nuts at the University of New South Wales. And it was so funny because I remember the director casting me in there and coming up to me on the night before we opened and saying, taking me aside and saying, when we cast you, I remember you could sing. And don't know what's happened, which was a great kind of note to get on the night before you open. But that show, I think that was the start of it. And then I had a piece of meat that was a prop and I threw it the wrong way. It was actually a real piece of meat. It was a huge hunk of meat. I threw it the wrong way and it hit somebody in the audience in the face and kind of knocked them out. And I kind of went, oh, geez, that was full on. And the show had to keep going. And, you know, Mr. Mushnick was kind of giving me the eye and saying, keep going. It's like, well, there's someone been hit in the face with a piece of meat that I threw. I'm kind of responsible for that. And I think it was then that I realised that I wasn't an actor. I also auditioned for NIDA like a lot of people did. I think we all have the dream thing.
Oh, yes.
And kept wondering why I didn't get through. And when I look at it now, it's because I was terrible. So, yeah, I think I wanted to direct, which I still love doing. But in the end, I know that I always loved writing. And so it makes sense now. But it's funny because I don't think that in the 80s when I was growing up that there was I had a real awareness of the fact that I could be a playwright. But the same as I didn't have an awareness of the fact that I could live as a gay man and that would be okay, because I think it wasn't necessarily something that was part of the world that I grew up in. Even though, you know, it sounds ridiculous because I was really privileged to have parents who run a youth theatre company, but it still didn't kind of occur to me that I could make a living from doing that.
So when did that happen? When did you realise you could? And how did it come about?
I started writing quite late, actually. I wrote things. And I did write a play when I was at high school, which I kind of I co-wrote it with the girl called Michelle, who wrote the music, and I wrote the lyrics and the script. And we did it with almost the entire Year 11 group. So I did it then, but I kind of then put it aside, and I wanted to act, and I was, you know, I was doing a lot of other things. And I think then in your 20s, you kind of got to live life a bit more, and people weren't so concerned about what they were going to do with their lives. The 20s seemed like this thing that sprawled out forever, whereas now I talk to people in their 20s and, you know, they're all finishing their doctorates or doing this, and it's like, geez, I don't know what happened to that time. But I think I trained to be a teacher, and I kind of started to live life, you know, being more comfortable with my sexuality and exploring that, which of course is a lot of fun, and traveled, which I love doing. So I think I decided to leave teaching when I was in my late 20s and did postgrad at BCA as a director. And then in that year that I was doing directing, I did some workshops with Jenny Kent, who I think has inspired so many people in Melbourne. And she was really encouraging. And then I wrote what I kind of consider my first play. So I was 29 when I wrote my first play. So I started very late, which is, I don't think is a bad thing. So I feel like I work with a lot of emerging writers now, and it's a lot of fun, but often there's not a lot of life experience to draw on if you're trying to be a successful playwright at 21. There's not enough that's happened in your own life to maybe draw on the kind of sense of what you need to be a playwright, which I think is, you know, an eye for a lot of different details, but also a kind of understanding of how the world works and a worldview that you can also, you know, apply to what you're writing.
Mm. So do you want to talk a little bit about your writing? Because you do, from my experience or what my observation is, write a lot, not verbatim, but from real story or real people, things that are of interest. You know, how do you find these, the what is of interest to you and the inspiration, I suppose? Where do you draw your ideas?
That's such an interesting question at the moment, I think, too. You know, because I found it really interesting that some people seem to have become very inspired in this time, and others have kind of, you know, found it very challenging and dried up creatively. Mm. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's a time at the moment where I'm asking what our role is, and I think it needs to be changed. So I'm not kind of hurrying to write, you know, 20 monologues about being in isolation, because I don't think the world needs them. I think in the past, some plays sort of come up and, like, grab you from behind and they write me. Mostly for me, it's either about hearing a particular story, particularly I think in the plays that I've written for young people. So I think, you know, I'll hear a particular story and wonder how that could have actually happened and what the consequences were for the people involved. Or it may be something as simple as witnessing a particular moment that, you know, that you just happen to be in the right place at the right time. So say with Silent Disco, yeah. I was teaching playwriting, young playwrights in the Netherlands, and we went to a theatre festival after we'd finished the workshops for the day, and there was a silent disco in this theatre festival, and it was actually the place where the silent disco originated, and they brought it in to begin with because the people who were involved in the festival wanted to dance after all the shows had finished, but the neighbours had complained, and so they decided to use. But I was in this silent disco and, you know, having a good time. And then I saw these two, like a young couple, over the side of the silent disco, were dancing together, and then suddenly there was an argument, and one threw, you know, she threw her headphones off and he stormed out, and I kind of went, oh, wow, that's such an amazing moment. I want to make a play about that. And then I think you start to accumulate things in your head, and then you go, oh, now I'm ready to write that play. So a few incidents has happened after that that kind of added to that. And you start thinking about ideas and so on. So often that's how it starts. I think with the work I've written for queer audiences, it's a bit different. It's probably a bit more reactive either to what's going on and, you know, kind of outrage at certain things that are either maybe going on outside the queer community and affecting them or within. And sometimes it's about, you know, a kind of revisionist view to a story that's not been told from a perspective of queerness yet. So, you know, for example, The Trouble with Harry, I think I was really irritated by the fact that you know, it seemed to be a very kind of heteronormative view of the whole story, and I wanted to address that and look at it from a different angle. So yeah, and then, you know, I guess they're the two kind of two areas that I kind of try and write in. If I get commissioned to do a work that isn't queer, I'll try and bring a queerness into it, because I feel that it wouldn't be me if it wasn't, if it didn't have that angle. Although it's interesting, I mean, obviously you can write from any angle, and I think, you know, a lot of the conversations about what people are allowed to write at the moment need to be teased out and nuanced further. But yeah, I think, you know, for me, I'm always really interested in queering up the world that the audience will see on stage in my plays.
And the more often we're seeing it on stage, the more, I don't know, balance somehow can potentially happen, I suppose. Is there a particular play that you are most proud of, or was most challenging for you to work with or write?
I think the one that comes to mind, I mean, I obviously like some plays better than others. I think everyone who writes would say that. And it does depend on how the production goal and the process. I mean, you know, some plays come out really easily and you think, oh, how did that happen? And then others, you know, you really struggle over. I had a play on a year or two ago now called Lost Boys. That was probably the hardest play I've ever written, because it involved a lot of research, and a lot of the material that I needed wasn't available to the public. So I had to kind of do undercover stuff and, you know, contact journalists or do clandestine interviews with people who didn't want to be known and so forth. But it was about the gangs of teenagers who bashed and killed a lot of men on the coast of Sydney in the 80s and 90s. And I think it was a difficult area to research. And obviously not as difficult as having been a victim or being related to somebody who had been, but it was still a really difficult world to sit in and work on every day. And it was also very difficult to write a play about that without it making, you know, without it being miserable and so forth. And I think that's why I ended up going working on a story that was from the viewpoint of the the people who committed the crime, and tried to get in and understand that. And I think it's, I guess that you know, that we seem to have a problem in Australia at the moment where plays premiere and are seen once and then they no longer have a life. Certainly something that I was trying to address in my very short spell at Playwriting Australia. You know, the idea of lost plays and why they're lost, and, you know, the waste around that loss. So for Lost Boys, had a short season in Wollongong, and despite every single reviewer who saw it, Sydney reviewers came down to see it saying it should have a Sydney season or should have a further life, it never has. And, you know, I find it remarkable in the sense that you have a story which is quite epic. I mean, it's set between 1989 and 2017. So the second act is in the marriage referendum during that period, which again is really important to document our history and on the stage. But I find it remarkable that a play like that has not had a further life at all.
Incredible.
Yeah, because it's so, you know, I think Sydney siders particularly like to actually these stories that are about their city. And, you know, so if we go back to kind of bounce back to something you asked me a fair time ago about programming choices. Yeah, I think the programming choices of theatre companies overall, I mean, I don't think, I think, well, theatre, sorry, I'll start that again. The programming choices of theatre companies need to be a bit bolder. They need to actually take on board that people in Sydney want to see shows about Sydney. They need to, I think, be increasing the amount of Australian work that's seen. And it's not just about new and emerging voices. It's also about, allowing audiences to actually have loyalty to playwrights and enjoy the sense of a body of work, which they used to do. I mean, you know, you look at historically, careers of Australian playwrights, that theatre supported, more than one production of their work, which allowed them to have a career, but it also allowed the audience to have a relationship with their writing in a way that, you know, was kind of chronicling, like, you know, look at some of Louis Naur's work and what it chronicled, I think is really, really interesting. But we don't seem to, the industry doesn't seem to allow playwrights to have a body of work anymore. It's working against it almost, which is problematic.
Well, you're listening to Stages. I'm Regina Botros, and I am talking with playwright Lachlan Philpott. I always like to ask, you know, the theatre has been so hard hit. What do you think is important about theatre and its contribution to culture, and why, you know, how important it is?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think perhaps theatre artists have been resting on their laurels a bit. I think that there's a whole lot of things that people say in response to that question, which, you know, everyone who would be listening would have heard before about, you know, the fact that theatre is one of the only places where people can come together and see something happen in real time and experience together. But I also think it's a time when we need to be adapting, and we need to be asking, what is the value of theatre? And we talk about it having the power to change people. We talk about it being able to support the education of people and so forth. But I'm not sure that that's what theatre in Australia is actually doing at the moment. And it's a good time for us to actually look at what is our role, and not just to assume that it doesn't change or that it doesn't have fluidity. In some ways, I think it's a great time for institutions to really take a look at the way that they're operating. You know, it's about affecting people in a particular moment and hopefully calling them to some sort of action or some response. And I think just call it storytelling sometimes makes it feel a bit banal.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is important to survive as a creative or as a playwright, and what advice would you give to someone?
Look, I think it's unrealistic to expect that you can survive only working as a playwright in Australia, probably almost anywhere now. It's just not possible to actually pay your bills. And that's a really sad thing to say. I feel like I was kind of at the tail end of a couple of generations who may have been able to do it at a pinch. And, of course, there's a few playwrights who've been very successful, but most really struggle. And it's a conversation that's not really had very, very often.
Or honestly.
Or honestly, that's right. In order to survive, you have to actually, I think, be doing more than just getting by as well, or meeting the next bill and then worrying about it. Doesn't help. I think the myth about poverty inducing creativity is that it's a myth. We need to be able to live reasonably comfortably in order to be able to make art, like you have to, you know, like we do for any other work. But I think it's about, you know, to survive as a playwright or to even start as a playwright, you can have talent, but you need to be able to dedicate time. You need to be able to know the work of others. You need to be able to listen and be humble. You also, I think, need to understand that it's quite a long, long road if you want to stay with it. But then, I don't know, I think, as I said, since the making a career as a playwright is a bit of a myth, it's probably better advice to either find a rich partner and, have a great and sustainable lifestyle through that, or have another job that you can fall back on that you also find satisfying and love. So there isn't pressure to create. Because I think the reality of being a playwright and doing nothing else is you have to create probably, well, four or five works a year, and they have to be on, etc. And obviously playwrights can do work in other areas, and I think probably the most promising area for the future is TV. You know, so having skills to be able to write in lots of different genres or formats, etc., is really important as well. I love writing lyrics, for example, and I've kind of got into that in the last couple of years, and it's just so different from writing for theatre, where it can take years and years to go on, and then it's a short season. You know, can take a couple of hours to write the lyrics for a song, and then, you know, I've been working with Paul Mack, and he kind of creates the music that day, and then we hear the song, and that can live forever. You know, so it's a very, very different. It's being able to diversify your skills, and it's not being precious about what you do. But I think it would also be helped a huge amount if plays had a longer life. You know, I mean, how many plays should a playwright be expected to write to sustain their career? And how come it's changed so much? When I look at some of, like, you know, I guess the people who I'd consider my elders in the industry, the amount of work that they've actually produced, it's great work, but some of them are not as prolific as we might think, and they've been able to survive, and it's because they were able to have many seasons of work, and you know, of many seasons of the same play, and that obviously generated a whole lot of things that isn't really happening at the, now. But I mean, I don't know. It's also speculative, isn't it? Who knows whether what the theatre industry will be like, you know, in a year or two. It's very difficult to say. This is it's an interesting time too, because there does seem to be an increased interest in moving stage plays to screen, you know, and that's very exciting. And certainly there's some amazing plays that should be adapted. Not all of them necessarily a fit, but what's concerning is that writers will give their play away for way too little, and they don't have any control over the work, and they actually don't own the work in that context either. So, you know, when your play is optioned for a film, it is owned by the producer or the person who's optioned that. Mm. And playwrights don't understand that, because it's a very different system, and, you know, the context of moral rights is not applicable when you're moving into the film industry. So there are areas like that where you know, playwrights also really need to know their stuff and not just assume that people are good and that they will do the right thing, because it doesn't always happen.
But you had that as a playwright as well. I mean, you a work of yours was you decided to take your name from it because it had lost all of its, I don't know, ownership?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question, and I think that there's a degree of, you know, to and fro within that, the relationship between of a new play going to stage and what the choices the director and the creative team make. But then I think there's also very clear moments when the intention of the play is compromised and the writer is not able to stand up and say that they're happy with what the creative process has delivered to the stage. And certainly in that case in Perth, I felt that the work that had gone to stage was really in breach of a lot of the promises that I'd made to the people who I'd interviewed for the material for the work, which was about them being abducted by aliens. That was delicate. Essentially, I'd promised them that they wouldn't be ridiculed, or that that what they'd been through wouldn't be diminished, and it was. And so I couldn't stand by that work, because it would have felt like a betrayal.
And confronting it. Well, Lachlan Philpott, thank you so much for your time today.
Peace, Regina. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was Lachlan Philpott, calling to action, playwriting, and be diverse. These are strange times, and it's great to have a very honest discussion about the reality of working in the theatre.